Well, in just less than 2 weeks now, we will be observing the Feast of Trumpets. And that, as I mentioned in the announcements, is a kind of a kickoff for the first day of the fall holy day season for this year. And then for the next 3 weeks, beginning on that day, we'll be reviewing a number of events that will take place in the future, a number of events that will occur leading up to, and for that matter, following the return of Jesus Christ and his rulership over the earth. Those events that we look forward to and that we observe each year during the fall holy days really form the basis of our understanding of prophecy. You know, people like to talk about prophecy. They like to look at those scriptures hold a special fascination because, for one thing, we anticipate that they could be fulfilled, at least some of them, in our lifetime. And so there's a particular interest. But you know, most of our understanding of prophecy has to do with our observance of those fall holy days. The events that happen surrounding, leading up to, and following the days themselves, at least what we see that they represent. I think it's safe to say that all of Bible prophecy, from our perspective, from our view of it, has something to do with and is in the context of our understanding of those days. This morning I'm going to review with you a Bible study that I've given at the Feast of Tabernacles, most recently at Lake Harmony, about 3 years ago. In this study, I try to provide you with an overview of the sequence of events that will take place, that Bible prophecy says will occur leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. Some of you have seen this study. Most of you probably have not. You do, as a group, tend to carefully choose feast sites other than where I am. So this will give me an opportunity then to share this particular study with you. Now, you'll see as we go through it that it's going to be very much of an overview. And I could repeat that basically with every point that I make in the study, but I'll just make it this one time. We could easily expand at certain points in the study and make it a series of several. In fact, maybe someday we'll take the time to do that. Remember I talked about a timeline and where we are in the timeline and where major events might be, and I think it would be interesting maybe to take that approach to we get a certain points that we'll see it on, in our discussion here. We could pause and expand that timeline to cover one incident or situation or a period of time in much more detail. But for today, we'll take the approach of an overview. I will be reviewing a lot of scriptures, and that's why I'm doing it in this format. You can follow along in your own Bible if you'd like, but if you'd rather just look at the projection of the passage on the screen, that'll help you keep up maybe a little bit better. You have a handout, and it is essentially an outline of what we'll be covering today, and a little bit of room on it if you'd like. You can add some notes. It's not my full set of notes, but it is. It shows the major bullet points that we will be covering in the study. Do any of you not have a copy of the handout? We need one up here, a couple here on this side. If we can make sure that everyone, and there are plenty of copies, so everyone is free to have your own copy if you'd like. As we begin, we'll be covering some of the material, or reviewing some of the material that I've touched on in the last couple of sermons, where we've talked quite a lot about the Olivet Prophecy. Okay, somebody's blockheads are in the way here. Okay, I'm clicking on the right arrow. In advance. Pardon me?
I can drive.
You can drive, okay. like a guy. He has to drive. I think we got it running now. Okay. Maybe if I stand at the back of the room. Okay, we'll maybe get this going. All right. We begin, as we have noted a couple of times recently, with the disciples talking among themselves, and they were impressed with how impressive, they were impressed with how awesome the temple was, and it represented to them their nation, their culture, and their history, and they took a lot of pride in that building. And so as they spoke, some of them spoke of the temple and how it was adorned with beautiful stones. These things which you see, Jesus said, the days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another that will not be thrown down. So they asked him when that would occur. When would be the signs of when that would take place? Being so proud of their culture and their history, they wanted to know what Jesus meant by that statement. So back in Matthew 24, verse 1, Jesus again says he departed from the temple. And this is a similar account. Matthew's words, this exchange a little bit differently. He takes into account the end of the prophecy in which Jesus speaks of his return. So Matthew has just a slightly different angle on the statement and on what Jesus said to the disciples. But in both accounts, the disciples wanted to know what they should be aware of, what they should watch for, that would indicate that the temple was about to be destroyed and that he would soon return. The phrase used here, the end of the age, implies the conclusion of one period of time followed by the beginning of a new period of time. One age ends, the other begins. That new age, of course, is the time when Jesus Christ would return to establish his kingdom. So Jesus' answer to that question is recorded in the Olivet Prophecy, in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, each give an account of that prophecy. But also remember that Jesus also inspired, in fact, spoke many of the words that are in the book of Revelation, which is also about the end of the age. And so as we look at Jesus' prophecy that he gave, it's recorded as the Olivet Prophecy, we also will take into account his words in the book of Revelation. So we'll be looking there somewhat, as well as at other prophecies that are relevant to this time frame. That looks like I'm going backwards, but that's what my notes say is supposed to be up there. Now, there are a number of ways that we could analyze the prophecy that Jesus gave at the Olivet Prophecy. We could start with verse 4 and just continue on and read right straight through. We could start maybe at the end and work our way back to start with the conclusion. I'm going to start right in the middle. I've chosen to start with an event that takes place that is not at the beginning or at the end, and we'll work both directions from that one particular occasion. The reason I've chosen to do that is because this is the one part of the prophecy that is specific. The conditions that Jesus described are general, both in terms of what leads up to this event and what follows it. But this is a specific event that we can be aware of that is going to happen, and we can start that with that specific prophecy and work to see what happened before and what follows afterward. In Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16, Jesus says this, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," so that's an event that will occur. There will be a time when this abomination of desolation will stand in the holy place. "Then, when you see that," he says in verse 16, "let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." This is a specific event that Jesus spoke of. Again, other parts of this prophecy are more general in nature. And so we can use this and recognize that when it does occur, it will be a trigger for other major events that will follow. So we need to find out then, what is the abomination of desolation that Jesus says will be set up in the holy place? We turn back to Daniel 11, and we're going to just read one verse out of from the chapter, verse 28. Now, this is a lengthy prophecy. Many of you are aware of it. It was given by Daniel in the year 539 B.C., and it covers time beginning with that date or that time of Daniel, clear through to the time of the return of Jesus Christ. It is very detailed in some areas, and as you understand what is now history, but at the time it was given was prophecy, you see that exactly, that this prophecy was fulfilled exactly as Daniel gave it. The king of the north, you may recall, and again, we're not going to be able to take the time to go back all the way. You could begin in verse 30, about four verses before, begin in verse 24, and you can see a mention of the king of the north and the king of the south. These are the kings who initially ruled in this part of the world. There's a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, the fourth, Antiochus the fourth of Syria. Antiochus was like many other of these pagan kings. He was incredibly arrogant, and he added to his name Epiphanes. His name was Antiochus, but he added the name Epiphanes. That word means manifestation of God. So that's how he viewed himself. He was, a pagan ruler who felt who was a very arrogant man. At that time, King Ptolemy the VI was king of Egypt. And verse 28 is speaking of a time when there's a battle between Antiochus and Ptolemy, a battle which Antiochus wins. And when he returns to his land, and again, this all took place back in about the year 164 B.C. It was about 400 years after Daniel had prophesied it, but now already fulfilled. Antiochus returned from the battle, having defeated Ptolemy. And it says in verse 28 that while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so that he will do damage and return to his own land. On his return, Antiochus was traveling from Egypt up north and west to Syria, and he traveled through Judea. As he did, he paused along the way to do harm to the people of Judea, to the Jews. And then he continued on his way to his home. Again, this occurred in the year 168. Now, the next verse, saying that at the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south. But it will not be like the former or the latter, what happened before or what will happen later. Verses 30 and 31 show that there was another battle, and this one Antiochus lost. He lost this battle, and he was defeated, it says in verse 31, that by those armies that were gathered against him. So this time, as he passed back through Jerusalem on his way to Syria, he took out his frustrations on the Jews. These are the people of the Holy Covenant. As he passed through Jerusalem, he defiled the sanctuary fortress, that is the temple, and he interrupted the Jews' practice of their religion. He prevented them from continuing their worship, and he specifically prevented the priests from offering sacrifices at the temple, on the altar. And in the place of, or at the place of the altar, he erected this, as it says in verse 31, this abomination of desolation. Secular history gives a lot of gruesome details about how Antiochus waged a war against the Jewish people. And he tried to destroy their religion. Their religion was outlawed. Those who practiced it were subject to torture and death. And he placed at the altar a pagan idol. And he, to further insult the Jews, intentionally sacrificed unclean animals on the altar, pigs in particular, because he knew how offensive that would be to the Jewish people. This word abomination means something that is loathsome, abhorrent, or detestable. And that's how the Jews felt about this pagan idol that was placed at the altar and the unclean sacrifices offered on the temple, or on the altar. So we saw then in Matthew 24, in the Olivet prophecy, that Jesus said this same event would be repeated, and that one like this, a circumstance like this, would take place just prior to other serious events. When people who are aware that this is going to happen see it, then they know that they must not remain in Judea. They must not remain near Jerusalem. That doesn't mean elsewhere necessarily, but it means those who are in that immediate vicinity need to leave. Once again, just point out or emphasize that Jesus spoke in generalities about other events that would happen at this in this period of time. But he said that in verse 29 of Luke 21 that we should look at the fig tree and all the trees, and we know from their cycle that when they're budding, you know that summer is near. And so when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. We're going to talk about the other things that he said would be happening, but this is one particular event that he identified that will take place. So we're going to back up then. We've seen that this one specific event will take place. Now we're going to back up and talk about what happens to lead up to that. What happens before the time when the abomination of desolation is established? We see that we're going to cover quickly five different aspects of things that will take place before the abomination of desolation is established. First of all, we'll talk about what Jesus described as general trends. What's happening in the world in general that will lead up to the time of the setting up of that pagan shrine. There it is. We've covered this recently, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. These are general conditions described in Matthew 24, verses 4 through 7. General conditions and trends that have prevailed ever since the days of Jesus Christ. He warned of wars. He warned of religious deceptions. He warned of famine. He warned of pestilence. And this was the first part of the answer that he gave to his disciples as he began to describe those events of the end time. So these are all very general. And these are conditions that people have noticed, that the world has experienced all along. But we remember as well that the book of Revelation also, as I said, includes prophecies from Jesus Christ describing events at the end of the age. So really it's a companion to the Olivet prophecy. And in Revelation 6, we see that a scroll, which had been introduced in chapter 5, is opened. And each section of this scroll is open. There's a seal in each section, and it's broken, and the scroll is rolled out a little further. Each one introduces a kind of a condition or a trend which matches what Jesus described in the Olivet prophecy. The first seal in Revelation 6, verses 1 and 2, describes what we understand to be a time of religious deception, someone who appears on a white horse, but that we see elsewhere that sometimes those who appear to be righteous turn out to be very unrighteous. The second seal, described in verses 3 and 4, is a red horse, which it says represents war and death by war. The great sword or weapons are used represented by this rider. The third seal, another horse, is a black one, and it represents famine. The rider on the black horse represents famine, and the rider on the fourth seal, or the fourth horse, is pale or sickly in color, and it represents widespread death caused by disease, pestilence. So each of those seals that is opened corresponds to the general description that Jesus gave in Matthew 24. So when we consider that, as I said, these events or these conditions have continued ever since the time of Jesus Christ, in one sense, these seals have already been broken and these prophecies are already being fulfilled. But we'll also see as we continue that as we approach the end of the age, there will be a specific fulfillment as well. The fulfillment of these same conditions will intensify as we draw closer to the time of the end of this age. So that is just a real quick overview of some of the general conditions that the world will deal with. Again, the things that we have dealt with, but they become much more intense as we continue. At the same time, we also should consider, as we proceed toward the abomination of desolation, what is happening to the nations of Israel. That is primarily to the United States and to Great Britain. In Deuteronomy 28, we find a prophecy about punishment that would come upon the nation if they were to disobey God, if they were to violate their covenant with Him. They did, we know, rebel against God, and they were punished severely, and eventually God allowed them to go into captivity. As it says in Deuteronomy 28:15, "It shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe carefully all His commandments and His statutes, which I command you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you." And then from that point to the end of chapter 28, the punishment that will come upon them is detailed. Now, we noted again in a recent sermon that the name of Jacob was specifically placed on Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. You read this account in Genesis 48. So when we understand that the nations of Great Britain and the United States have been the recipients of the special blessings promised to Abraham, we also recognize that nation, that our nations, once again have not, as a nation, accepted and obeyed and worshipped God as He would have, because we do not obey His commandments, we are also subject to the same punishment that Israel suffered earlier. So, another trend that we see is the continual decline of our nation. Consider the problems that we're facing. Our economy, wars, in particular the war on terrorism is something that is very much on people's minds now. The enormous cost in terms of people and money, of disease, natural disasters, declining moral values, political instability. There are a great deal of areas in which our nation is declining. In fact, it's interesting that you see a lot of the public opinion polls in recent months that people are very concerned about the conditions that we're in and the future. And most Americans today are convinced that their children's future is not as bright as it had been for previous generations. There is evidence that God is withholding his blessings from our nations. So the trends that we see that are generally described in Matthew 24, certainly we see as taking place within our nation today as well. I guess I need to hold my tongue just right. In Isaiah, the second chapter, we also see a description of how God views the nation and the sins that our nation is guilty of. Okay, I've got my pages out of order, so I'll just follow along the screen with you. This is the description of how God views his nation. The children that have rebelled against me, the ox knows its owner, the donkey knows its master's crib. In other words, it knows where to go to be fed. But Israel does not know, my people do not consider. Alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors. They have forsaken the eternal, they provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They've turned away backward. A general description of how God views his people and their rejection of the way of life that he has offered to us as a nation. These are the beginning of sorrows, as we saw in Matthew 24, verse 8. So we see a series of general trends that will take place and that will affect the nations. And these are things that Jesus said will take place leading up to the time of the abomination of desolation. Next we see the emergence, the next trend we'll discuss is the emergence or the rise of the end time beast power. And a strong political and military power is prophesied to emerge that will have a great impact on the nations. In Daniel 7, verse 7, he says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring in pieces and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. The previous verses describe three other world-ruling empires that would emerge. History shows that those empires were Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. Each of those was destructive in its own way and controlling, and dominated the earth during the time when they were in power. Each of these kingdoms was compared to an aggressive predatory animal. Babylon was compared to a lion, Medo-Persia was compared to a bear, and Greece was compared to a leopard. But this fourth beast was so terrible and so destructive that it could not be compared to any other animal that Daniel was aware of or had a way to compare it to. So he wanted to know more about that particular beast. He says, I wished to know the truth. This is Daniel 7, verse 19. The truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. It was exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured and broke in pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were upon its head. The 10 horns here represent a successive series of kings who were leaders over restorations of this fourth beast throughout history. We understand, and frankly many others do as well, other commentators and other students of Bible prophecy recognize that this beast represents the Roman Empire, which began in about the year 34 BC and continued to the year 476 AD. Since its original demise in 476, There have been 9 periods of time when the Roman Empire has been restored. And there is one more which is yet to come, which is the one that we will see described in Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13, it says, I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns were 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. The beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon, or the devil, gave him his power, his throne, and his great authority. So this symbolic language describes the emergence of an end-time nation which is empowered by Satan himself. The beast here is described as being a combination of what we saw in Daniel 7, part lion, part leopard, and part bear. But it was different and more vicious than any of those other animals. It has 7 heads and 10 crowns. These represent a governmental organization, a combination of nations and leaders who come under the authority of this one great beast or military political leader. Since this fourth beast that we saw in Daniel 7 can be identified as the Roman Empire, we look ahead for a great end time world-dominating power that will come from the seeds or the remains of the Roman Empire, which, of course, is in Europe. So we don't know exactly how that will come about, but it is something for us to be aware of and to watch to see how it does develop, how the nations of Europe at some point will come under the influence of a powerful leader to form that kingdom. The same chapter in Revelation also speaks of another kind of leader, a powerful religious leader who will work with that political military leader or the beast power. And I think I should also point out that these events that we're talking about, these trends, are not consecutive, but there are things that happen that are concurrent. All of these trends we've talked about, the events or the conditions in the world around us, and the developments that we're seeing will take place concurrently. In fact, the conditions in the world will lead to the emergence of these leaders. It will lead to the need for strong leadership in both political and religious arenas. And it will seem perfectly logical that these men will come and rise to power. And at first it will seem even as a good thing. But as they take more authority and more power, they will be very destructive in nature. The second leader that's spoken of in Revelation 13 is a great false religious leader. And we recognize that the roots of the church that Satan has used and developed over time go to the Roman Catholic Church. And it is from that area that we anticipate that this powerful religious leader will emerge. In Revelation 13, a little further down in the chapter, we see this description. He says, another beast comes up out of the earth. The first one came out of the sea. This one comes up out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven in the sight of men. This religious leader will initially appear to be a peaceful person, like a lamb, but in truth, he will be violent and cruel. At least ultimately, that's how he will behave. He has great authority himself, and he causes others to worship the political military leader that will emerge. He'll convince the world that he's a man of God by the miracles that he will seem to perform. He'll do things that are humanly impossible. Again, convincing people that he must therefore be of God. Jesus warned in Matthew 24 that there will be some miracles that are so powerful that they would even deceive those with understanding if it were possible. Thankfully, that will not be possible. Paul spoke of this individual in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He says, "The lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy," that is, when he returns. "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who are perishing, because they did not receive the love of the truth. And for this reason, God will send them a strong delusion." God will allow Satan to use this individual to deceive and confuse mankind. Those who do not have or love the truth of God will fall into that condition of being deceived. So we see then that there will be the great religious leader, as well as the end-time beast power, or the great political and military leader as well. Part of what's also going to continue during this time frame is the continuing and increasing conflict that we see occurring in the Middle East. In Luke's account of the Olivet Prophecy, Jesus warns that when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. And then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. This event was partially fulfilled in 70 AD. Jerusalem was surrounded, besieged, and eventually destroyed by the Roman armies led by General Titus. The city was destroyed, and the temple specifically was completely razed or destroyed. However, that did not fulfill the prophecy Jesus gave at the beginning of this chapter, because he said that not one stone would be left on top of another, that the temple would be completely and entirely destroyed. That has not happened yet. There is still one wall of that temple that remains. But it's a warning that it will happen, and then the temple would be completely destroyed at that future fulfillment. And we see that at that time, again, as we saw in Matthew 24, those who live in Jerusalem should realize that the destruction is about to occur. So we see actually, and this is part of that prophecy of the abomination of desolation, part of that same prophecy. When that is set up, when that pagan shrine is established, it will be accompanied by or be done at the time that there are armies surrounding the city. And as both of those instances occur, both of those situations come about, then the people who live in that immediate area are told to flee. Okay. Again, we go back to Daniel 11 and pick up another portion of this lengthy prophecy. It says, that at that time of the end, the king of the south shall attack, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind. In other words, there'll be a battle between these two opposing forces, the kings of the north and of the south, with armies and chariots and horsemen and ships. Verse 41, he shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. This, again, speaks of a time of this warfare in the area of the Middle East. The city of Jerusalem will continue to be a focal point for political and religious turmoil, as it is today, and has been for a couple of thousand years. The Israelis continue to deal with the Arabs, the Palestinians, fighting for the control of the Gaza Strip and other territory in the area. All three of the major religions of the world, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, lay claim to the city of Jerusalem. Time of continued conflict and warfare that will grow in the area of the Middle East. Even just recently, we've seen so much activity in that general area, the Middle East, Israel, and the Palestinians, and then along the Persian Gulf with all the various Arab terror groups that are forming. And there's been discussion recently of how those groups are going to start coming together and working together to be more effective in their alliances. So these areas of hostilities that are described in Daniel 11 continue to develop in the Middle East and in the Gulf states. So, again, it's speaking of the king of the south and the king of the north. The king of the south, we expect, will be an alliance of some kind of the Arabs and the terrorist groups. And the king of the north, north of that region, would be in the vicinity of and the formation of the military and political power of Europe. And that battle between the north and the south will continue to cause a lot of confusion and destruction in the Middle East. So as the world around us, as we see in the general trends, the rising of an end-time beast power, the emergence of a great religious leader, the increasing conflict in the Middle East, what will be the impact on the church during this time? Remember, again, these are all conditions that will arise leading up to the time when the abomination of desolation will be established. We'll not spend a lot of time here either because, again, we've covered this fairly recently in the sermons that I've given from the Olivet Prophecy. Matthew 27, verses 9 through 14, describe persecution and difficulty within the people of the Church of God. It talks about how you'll be delivered to tribulation, you'll be killed and hated by the nations, many will be offended and will betray one another, there'll be false prophets that will rise up and deceive many. And because of all this, because lawlessness abounds, because of the general conditions of society, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end, he who continues faithfully in spite of all these situations, these conditions, shall be saved. He'll be part of that kingdom that Jesus will establish when he returns. The need for endurance indicates that this time heading into the end of the age will be one of severe trial and stress and difficulty for God's people. Verse 14 speaks to the continuing work of the church, that even as certain conditions develop and grow, the church will continue its work, preaching the gospel, clear up to the end of the age. So this is all part of the general conditions that Jesus just said would occur, but this is also part of what he said would be the beginning of sorrows, that is the time leading up to, that is not part of the time of tribulation itself. Luke goes into a little more detail about these same situations and how they will, that there will be persecution, betrayal, even within the church and among family members during this time. So it's a time that will yet come that will affect the church very directly. We've had our struggles in the last years, but this is a time that's prophesied that will be much more intense than that. And as the other conditions are continuing to grow, this will be part of the development that will happen within the church. The key here for us is the enduring to the end. And verse 19 here in Luke 21 about your patience. The word patience could also be translated endurance. It is by our endurance that we will survive. By our patience, by our continuing practicing of God's way, even in difficult times, that is the key to the church during this period of time. So these are events then that occur before the abomination of desolation. We talked, first of all, about the setting up of that specific pagan shrine at the altar in Jerusalem. And we talked about then conditions that would lead up to, that would precede the time when that pagan shrine is set up at the altar. So what happens following? What happens after the time when the abomination of desolation has been established? Again, we'll cover five areas. We'll summarize this period of time in with five different explanations or areas: the tribulation of the nations, tribulation of the church. The third one really is more about that period of time. How long will it be? Then is followed by the day of the Lord and the return of Jesus Christ. So the first thing we'll discuss that will take place after the abomination of desolation has been established is what we'll call tribulation of the nations. And it essentially means a time of stress and difficulty among the nations of the world. And it's a time specifically of punishment that will come upon the nations of Israel. Matthew 24, again, it makes reference to the time when the abomination of desolation is established. When you see it set up, then let those who are in, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. But notice what's stated, and the translators have put it parenthetically. I think that's a good way to read this sentence. It says, whoever reads, let him understand. I think that phrase implies that not everyone who reads will understand. Not everyone will understand the significance of the abomination of desolation, that pagan shrine being set up. But those who do recognize what it means, then are warned to take action. If they live in Judea, they should flee to the mountains, and they should do so quickly, not bothering to make any provisions, but just to get to safe ground. Woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies, and pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. So, again, this setting up of the abomination of desolation is an important benchmark. The conditions that take place before it are kind of like pieces of a puzzle coming together, and the final piece is the abomination of desolation itself, that religious shrine of some sort that will be set up. It implies here that since it will take the place of the altar as has happened in the time of Daniel, it implies that there will be an altar and there will be sacrifices that have been reinstated by that time. Doesn't mean that there has to be a temple, but there must be a place, must be an altar set up at the proper location where it was when there was a temple standing, so that the sacrifices can be interrupted and replaced by the abomination. That in itself, the establishing of that sacrificial system, or the reestablishing of it, will add to the tensions in the Middle East, because the altar is located, the proper location for the altar is on the site of a Muslim shrine itself, the Dome of the Rock, is a very holy place in the Muslim religion. It's the place from which it is said that Muhammad ascended to heaven. And so if the Jews, or when the Jews, begin offering sacrifices, they reestablish an altar and are offering sacrifices to their God on that location, that's going to cause a great deal of tension and add to the explosive conditions in Jerusalem. So when the abomination is set up to take the place of that altar, then Jesus warned those who are there to get out, to leave for a safe place. Verse 20 is something that people often asked about. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. This sentence, first of all, establishes that those at the end of the age will be keeping the Sabbath. That's probably the most important thing we can gain from it. That God's people at the end of the age are still going to be observing the weekly Sabbath. But some wonder, if God has a plan, then how come he doesn't just make it so that it's not going to take place on the Sabbath or in the winter? Well, that verse indicates that the timing is somewhat variable. That is not a specific, exact, rigid schedule that God is going to carry out. There are other factors that are involved that could shift the exact time of needing to depart or flee to safety. So there's no assurance, right? It's according to a rigid plan or schedule that it will not be on a Sabbath. It shows the responsibility that we have to continue to seek God's guidance and God's will, and to recognize that these things, again, Jesus never set any specific dates. These things are variable, at least within a certain range. In Matthew 24:15, we see here then a description of what Jesus called the Great Tribulation, a time such as has not been since the beginning of the world, and no, nor ever shall be. That's quite a statement. There have been some very devastating events that have taken place on the earth. In fact, even the flood, for example. I mean, the whole earth was destroyed. But you see, God had protected specifically Noah and his family. At this point, the existence of mankind is even greater danger than it was back in the time of Noah. And it says that unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So this brutal domination by the powerful political military beast power that will arise will take absolute control over the earth and be controlled and dominated by a false religious leader. And he will take out their anger or frustration or work to dominate and control the rest of the earth. This combination of this military and political and religious power, along with the effects of what's already accumulated, famine, pestilence, natural disaster, war, all this will combine to create a time of unparalleled disaster, which will threaten the existence of mankind. Verse 22 says, unless these days be shortened. That's another puzzling phrase. Does it mean that God will reduce the time from what was originally planned, so that the earth will not be, or mankind will not be destroyed? There are some apparently definite and specific time periods that are revealed in prophecy. And there are examples in other scriptures that shows that God's timing is sometimes very specific and very precise. If that is true, then how is it that he could alter his own schedule to reduce this period of time? Or how is it that things advance so quickly that he has to change his plan in order to prevent something worse from happening. Is that what this verse means? Well, certainly it's possible that God can choose whatever he wants to as far as fulfilling his plan. I don't think any of us are going to come back later and say, well, wait a minute, that was supposed to continue for 4 more months and you cut it short. I don't think we're going to have any kind of discussion with God about that. He can complete his plan however he chooses to do so. But it's also possible that this phrase means that the time that God will allow for this tribulation to occur is already planned to be short enough that Satan cannot destroy the earth. In other words, this is a period we'll see of a certain duration. And that duration is that length of time so that Satan cannot advance or get ahead of God to destroy all mankind. One way or another, God will be merciful in this punishment that will take place, and mankind will be spared. Jesus Christ will intervene to end this period of time. The Great Tribulation is also described in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 30, verse 6. Ask now and see whether man is ever in labor with child. If not, then why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all their faces turned pale? Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, and it is the time of Jacob's trouble. But he shall be saved out of it. If this is a period of time that is like no other, and Jesus said the same thing of the Great Tribulation in Matthew 24, then it's talking about, these two verses both are talking about the same time. A unique time of difficulty for the nations of Jacob, that is, Israel. So it's clear that, and we've also reviewed many prophecies recently in the Minor Prophets, that the nations of Israel will take the brunt of this tribulation. Many nations on this earth today hate the United States, resent the wealth and the power that this nation has enjoyed. And in particular, of course, the Arab and the Islam nations of Islam, or Muslim nations. And so Israel will fall into a great time of punishment, which God will allow. And we see in the greater picture that brings people to repentance, to learn to serve God. So the emphasis we place on these prophecies is that we don't necessarily claim that we know exactly what's going to happen or when it's going to happen, but we know that certain events will take place, and we're watching for those trends that will lead to the fulfillment of those times. In Revelation 13, verse 4, they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? He'll give a mouth speaking great things. He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. He was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. So Satan is empowering this great beast power leader. There will be no other army or government that will be able to stand against him. He will be arrogant and blasphemous, claiming to either be powerful over God or to be God himself. And he'll be working in conjunction with a great false religious leader who actually will be in control of the beast and force others to worship the beast. This is part of the environment or the time of that tribulation that comes upon all of the nations at the hands of the beast and the false prophet. We see here in Daniel 2, it speaks of the fourth kingdom, which is what we've been talking about, the Roman Empire and its various iterations or revivals. It's as strong as iron. It breaks in pieces and shatters everything. This is, again, it's that tribulation that they will inflict on the rest of the earth. Its feet and toes are partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. The kingdom will be divided, but it will have the strength of iron in it. The toes also are partly iron and partly clay. So it's partly strong and partly fragile. It's an iron mixed with clay, verse 43. They'll mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not adhere to clay. So even though this final emergence of this great powerful leader will be very strong and dominate the world during this time of this tribulation, it has within it the seeds of its own destruction. It will be an unnatural combination of nations, which will only cling together or be able to work together for a short time. And it will continue up until the time when Jesus Christ returns. Verse 44, in the days of these kings, the kingdom of the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And God will destroy that nation and replace it with his. So there will be a time of tribulation in general on the nations, in particular on the nations of Israel, that will take place after the time of that abomination of desolation. During this time, there will also be a tribulation on the church. The church will suffer persecution during the time of the tribulation. Now, the church, as we noted, Christians have suffered persecution throughout the ages, but during the tribulation, we'll see that it will become much more intense and much more severe. We'll back up just a little bit and notice that we have then the time of the opening of the fifth seal in Revelation chapter 6, verse 9. It's described as the time when people who have been martyred or cry out to God for relief and for vengeance. Verse 11, they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge the blood of those who dwell on the earth?" Now, it's not they're not literally crying out to him, but their lives and their martyrdom represents the need for Jesus to intervene on their behalf for their situations. A white robe was given to each, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren, who would be killed as they were, was completed. So there have been those in the past who have been martyred for their faithfulness to God's truth and God's way, and there will be others who will have that suffer that fate in the future. We saw earlier that the first four seals have been opened and that there is a time of general persecution before the abomination is set up. Again, this will intensify. The persecution will intensify after the abomination is set up as well. And a false religion is imposed by this great false prophet. It says in Revelation 13, verse 7, it was granted to him, that is to the beast, to the military and political leader, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life, the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. This shows us that together the beast power, the great military leader, and the false prophet will bring persecution against the people of God. And they will be given authority to and allowed to overcome them. God will allow his people to suffer at the hands of this military and religious leadership. And he's allowed to control all the nations of the earth. Because of his seemingly unlimited power, people will be forced who do not understand. People who do not understand will be forced to bow down and to worship him and to carry out that evil leader's will. He'll have complete control over all of mankind except those whose names are written in the book of life, which means, of course, those who have received God's Spirit. Daniel, again, also spoke of this same circumstance. In his vision, this religious leader is pictured as the horn on the head of one of these beasts. Verse 21, I was watching, and the horn, same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So Daniel also prophesied that this leader would dominate and make war against God's people. In other words, he'll enforce the false religion and the worship of the beast. This is something that will take place during the time of the Great Tribulation. And as we saw back in Revelation a minute ago, he will be allowed, they will be allowed to prevail against the saints until the time when Jesus Christ returns. So there will be tribulation that will affect the church. Let's talk about how long this period of time is. How long will the tribulation last? Revelation 12:14 says that the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. We talked about the tribulation that will come upon the church, but we also see in this verse, first of all, that not all of the church will suffer the full brunt of that persecution. During the time of the persecution, the church, which is represented by a woman, flies into the wilderness, and she's nourished and protected for a time, times, and half a time. All right, so it's some important details here. First of all, there will be protection for the church during that time. Later in this same chapter, it speaks of a remnant of the church that will still be persecuted. And it says they'll be protected for this period of time. And we'll see in a moment how long that is. Revelation 11 speaks of a period of time during which, first of all, the Gentiles will dominate Jerusalem, and secondly, the two witnesses will be doing their work. The two witnesses are men that God uses in this time of the tribulation to continue to preach and teach about the kingdom. The church itself is either persecuted or in a place of protection, but there will be two, they'll continue to witness for God during that time. And this verse shows how long that will be. The Gentiles, it says in verse 2, are allowed to control the city of Jerusalem for 42 months. 42 months is a period of 3.5 years. We also saw, remember in Daniel 2, that this Gentile power will be destroyed when Jesus returns. So we would deduce then that Jesus Christ returns at the end of this 42 months. It also says in verse 3 that the two witnesses prophesy for 1,260 days. Now in the Hebrew calendar, the average length of a month is 30 days. So 1,260 divided by 30 is 42. So again, this is speaking of a period of 3.5 years that the Gentiles will tread down the courts of the temple or dominate in Jerusalem, and that the two witnesses will do will be doing the work that the God is, will give to them. One other verse that speaks of a period of time. We saw this earlier in Revelation 11, verse 5. The beast, the great political military leader, is given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he is given authority to continue for 42 months. Again, a period of 3.5 years. And again, we saw in Daniel 2 that he is that his kingdom is destroyed. He's broken at the time when Jesus Christ returns. So this period of 3.5 years ends when Jesus Christ returns. Consider again then for a moment the time when the church is protected. We saw in Revelation 12:14 that they'll be protected for a time, times, and half a time. Now, given what we've seen in the other passages, I think we can deduce how long that is. In some prophetic passages, a time is used to represent 1 year. The plural of the word times can represent more than one, or as I say, 2 years, and half a time is 6 months. So it's clear that this also can be seen to be a period of 3.5 years. And we put it in the context of the other specific prophecies, I think we can safely say that that's what that means. Time, times, and half a time means a period of 3.5 years. So it's our understanding that these periods of time, 42 months, 1260 days, time, times, and half a time, are all the same period of time. And it represents the time of the tribulation, which will be 3.5 years in length. And it will end at the time when Jesus Christ returns. Okay. So, we see the nations of the earth coming under tribulation. There's also a period of time when it says that Jesus Christ will punish the nations. And that period of time is called the Day of the Lord. So let's try to identify when the Day of the Lord will occur. Revelation 12:6, verses 12 through 17, it says, I looked and saw when he opened the sixth seal, there was a great earthquake. Now, the Day of the Lord is the seventh seal. This is not the Day of the Lord. But we'll see that this sixth seal leads into the time of the Day of the Lord. He opens the sixth seal. There's a great earthquake. The sun became black. The moon became like blood. The stars of heaven fell to the earth. The sky receded as a scroll, which is rolled up, and every mountain and island is moved out of place. Now, it's really hard to try to consider, try to understand just what is happening to make all these things occur. It's clearly a time of enormous natural disaster, that something is happening in the atmosphere to change the color of the sun and the moon. There's stars falling from heaven, possibly meteors. The sky is rolled back as a scroll. You tell me what that means. But there are just amazing, incredible, and terrifying things that are happening to the earth and that you can see in the sky. Verse 15, the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man, in other words, everybody, great men and not so great men alike, see these things, and they hide themselves in the caves, and in the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us. You know, they'd rather die than continue. They're so terrified. Hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for that great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand. The people recognize somehow that what is happening when this sixth seal is opened and the prophecies are fulfilled, they recognize that this means that the day of the Lord has come. I think the only way they're really going to have that kind of knowledge is because of what the two witnesses have been telling them, that these things are going to come. And, of course, probably rejected and ridiculed and not believed. But now it hits home. Now they begin to see that time is coming, and great fear will fill them. Jesus mentioned this in the Olivet Prophecy. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun is darkened, the moon doesn't give us light, the stars fall from heaven. So it doesn't say after the end of all the tribulation, but what is when we get to a certain point, when these things have happened, what's next is that the sun and the moon are darkened, the stars fall from heaven. Verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Again, a little bit of a mysterious phrase. What does it mean that sign will appear? Perhaps it also is part of why we saw in Revelation 6 that they realize that the day of the Lord is beginning. There'll be some evidence of that, either by the fulfillment of predictions and prophecies or by some specific evidence that they'll see. But all the tribes of earth will mourn, and they'll see that ultimately the return of Jesus Christ. So we see that these events take place at the end of that period of time. Verse 13, verse 6 through 11 of Isaiah 13 describes as well the day of the Lord and how at that time Jesus will punish all of the nations, and he will begin to intervene. So this is called the Day of the Lord. Scripture also uses a day to represent a year. Remember, Israel was punished for 40 years because the unfaithful spies returned and gave a bad report after spending 40 days in their promised land. These events described in Revelation 8, Revelation 9, and Revelation 15, the time of the seventh seal, which is represented by the Feast of Trumpets, we believe take place over the period of a year. So we find then that this time of tribulation is 3.5 years. During that time, the church, much of the church, is in a place of protection. During that time, the nations of Israel are severely punished. During that time, the beast power and the false prophet dominate, and the two witnesses are giving predictions or prophecies of what's going to happen next. During that period of time, those events continue. And it's for the first 2.5 years, apparently, that the beast power and the false prophet are used to punish Israel. And it is the final year of that full 3.5 years of tribulation when Jesus Christ will punish the rest of the nations. And his punishment of the nations leads up to and is concluded by his return. The seventh angel sounded. Again, you look in the context. That's the seventh trumpet that's blown during the seventh seal. The seventh seal is a series of seven events, each of which is preceded by the sounding of a trumpet. And when the seventh angel sounds, then there's an announcement proclaimed that the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And then it is at this point, then, that the prophecies we saw of the destruction of the beast power and the religious leadership, the false religious leadership, reaches its conclusion because Jesus Christ has returned to take his place as the king of the earth, the King of Kings, and he will reign, it says, forever and ever. And in the days of these kings, those are the ones that were the four, series of four that we see in Daniel 2, and specifically the last of those kingdoms. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom and it will never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to others, and will consume all the other nations, and it shall stand forever. We also know that it's at that time that Jesus Christ will lock Satan away. We find that in Revelation 20, so that he is no longer able to deceive the nations. The rulership of Jesus Christ over the earth is what, of course, we'll be emphasizing as we observe the Feast of Tabernacles and the eighth day, the day of the White Throne Judgment, when Jesus and his saints will rule over the earth. Well, there's a lot that we tried to cover and that we understand a series of events. We don't know exactly when they're going to happen or exactly, in each case, how it will happen. But we see that these are things that Jesus warned that we should be aware of and that we should watch for, and that will lead to a time of great challenge. Perhaps these will occur in our lifetime. We're not sure whether these times of tribulation and difficulty, persecution, and so on will occur in our lifetime, but they will occur. Jesus Christ has made it clear that these are events that will come about that will eventually lead to his return. As I've said many times, the importance of knowing these things is something that we can be clear on. We don't know, again, exactly how or when these events will take place. But as Peter said in 2 Peter 3:11 here, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, he's speaking about the earth being replaced by a new earth at some point in the distant future. But since everything on this earth, Peter says, is going away, and we understand that, we know from prophecy that these events are going to take place. Knowing that, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Therefore, beloved, verse 14, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless. The important thing for us is to realize that these events are going to take place, and that we need to, understanding that, we need to be living in a way that pleases God, living in a way, personally preparing for the return of Christ, and living in a way that would honor him by our life, so that whenever these things do occur, then we will be, Peter says, found at peace. In other words, have that right relationship with God, and so that we're not afraid of events that could take place in our lifetime. We can be sobered by them and realize they're going to be very difficult times. But we realize that what we need to do is simply be faithful in the way that we live each day. Or as Paul put it, that our understanding about Jesus Christ teaches us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our God and Savior, Jesus Christ. The message of the gospel, the message of prophecy, both teach us to live carefully and to recognize that we live in an age that is not godly, but looking ahead to, and living in a way that will prepare us for a place in God's kingdom when Jesus Christ will return. So, I hope that even though we went through some things very quickly, that it can help us to have a general understanding of the conditions that we are in and that will come about between now and the time when these holy days that we're about to observe will be fulfilled, to help give us some context and understanding of the significance of the days that we will soon be observing.